here and just talk about yourself.
Now, I've only known Harold a day, and that's the shortest I've ever seen him on words. He's normally like Dan. He just goes on and on and on. Kind of like the Energizer Bunny. Thanks for this powerful introduction, Harold. I'm Jerry Weaver. I'm an alcoholic. Sobriety date is July the 2nd, 1989. Everybody hear me all right? My home group is a group called There Is a Solution. We meet in Holly Springs, North Carolina, on Tuesday and Thursday, 7 o'clock. If you're ever in the Raleigh area, come check us out. They wrote a chapter about us in the big book. Put that down. I've been known to steal stuff like that. Which you'll hear about in a minute. And it's good to be here. Harold, thanks for the hospitality. Harold's been an excellent host. Robert, thanks for asking me, and everybody else that I know. A lot of people here and have been welcomed and have been fed and have been told kind words, which sometimes don't seem like they're actually accurate. But it's good to be amongst a group of folks that are enthusiastic about Alcoholics Anonymous and about recovery and staying sober and probably most importantly, helping other people. That's kind of the message of Alcoholics Anonymous. And it's my good buddy Steve flew in with me, so I appreciate you coming down. It was funny, we had a pretty long trip trying to get here with thunderstorms. We had to deboard the plane in Raleigh and then had to get back on it, and we got out there and the lightning hit again. It was about a 4-hour process of just getting out off the ground, and I kept texting Harold, and I'm like, he's going to think I'm drinking all these text messages I'm sending. it was just kind of bizarre, and but anyway, we got here. Good to be here. We played golf today. Now here's something funny. So me and Steve rode with Trey and Carl over to the golf course, and they were talking about how they were going to win this tournament, and everything was great, and they finished quick, and they had a really low score, and it appeared like they were going to win. And then all of a sudden, this team comes in with a score that's two shots better than theirs, and we could just see Carl was like, man, like this. And Trey was, feelings were hurt. And I mean, they were pretty convinced they were going to win. And then we get in the car, and they're like, yeah, I can't believe that guy brought those two ringers with him. And then I don't even think they were alcoholics. They weren't supposed to be here. I am not making this up. I probably shouldn't be telling it. And then the best one was, yeah, you know, those two of those guys were in their 20s. I'm pushing 60. That was Carl saying that. So they lost because they're getting older. But anyway, hey, I'm a guy that absolutely could not quit drinking. Before I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I had a lot of well-intended people try to help me get sober. Psychiatrists and preachers, high school principals, chief of police, a couple of deputy sheriffs, first sergeants, in-laws, parents, my brother. And no matter how hard they tried, I never could stay sober. And one day I was sitting in a detox, and a guy from Alcoholics Anonymous came in and talked to me. And I had no knowledge of Alcoholics Anonymous, didn't know anything about alcoholism. I mean, I was 22 years old, and when that guy came and talked to me, his message was completely different than anyone I'd ever talked to up to that point in my life. He came in and he sat down. He never asked me a question. He never told me anything. He didn't throw a meeting directory in my face with a bunch of numbers on it. He told me to go to 90 meetings in 90 days. He didn't give me a big book. He didn't tell me to put the plug in the jug. He didn't ask me how I was doing. I'm sitting there in a funny blue outfit on suicide watch. I mean, how do you think I'm doing? He just simply talked about himself. He talked about how he was hopeless and how alcohol had destroyed his life. He talked about his struggles of trying to stop, and he talked a little bit about the physical allergy and the mental obsession. And I immediately identified with that man, and I've been sober ever since. And what happened that morning or that day was that it's what we call the language of the heart. And one of the most important things in Alcoholics Anonymous is identification. And that's what happened that morning when that guy came in and talked to me. It was for the first time in my life, there was somebody that actually understood how I felt and understood what I'd done, what I'd been through. And at that point in my life, I thought I was absolutely alone. I thought no one understood. And I was just completely isolated from society and from people. And all those feelings of being different and not fitting in and thinking that nobody cared or nobody understood, they basically started to dissipate when that guy talked to me. And that identification, you know, helped me to realize that maybe there was hope for me, and that maybe that I could have some kind of life that would have some sense of normalcy, and I could maybe have some purpose in my life. And I'm a guy that has been absolutely blessed by Alcoholics Anonymous and the people in Alcoholics Anonymous. I've grown up in Alcoholics Anonymous, and from the time that I got here to now, every decision and everything that I have ever done has been filtered through our principles and through a home group and through sponsorship. And none of those decisions have ever failed me. I'm not trying to imply that my life has been perfect and it's all been fruity pebbles and foot massages and all that. But even in my darkest times sober, which there's been many, Alcoholics Anonymous and the power that I found in Alcoholics Anonymous has been sufficient to help me get through that. And most importantly, not take a drink. And if you're here tonight and you're sober, you've beat the odds. Like most of us don't make it, and most alcoholics are out drinking right now and dying. And we're exceptions if we're here tonight. And that I don't take that lightly. That's an absolute gift and an absolute privilege. And I'm honored to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm not a guy that goes to meetings or hits meetings. I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that means I have a home group and I have a sponsor and I have a service commitment. I've taken the steps. I try to help other people. I don't have a network. I call my sponsor. Yes, and so anyway, I'll get off all that. I grew up in a family where there was a lot of drinking going on, a lot of partying, and it was one of those deals where they'd have a party and people would get in a fight or something bad would happen. Next morning we'd wake up and act like nothing happened. Be bullet holes in the walls or holes in the walls or dad have a cast on his arm, and you know, it's like nobody would ask any questions about what was going on. And I saw what alcohol did to people, and I mean, I'd have these thoughts, boy, I'm not going to be like that when I get older. It's going to be different for me. Looking back on it now, I grew up in my parents were pretty cool. I think they're pretty cool today. There was a while I didn't think that, but they'd have these parties, and my dad had this bar that had all kinds of liquor, and he had in the early 70s, and he had these black lights and these old velvet posters that would like glow when he'd light those things up, and he'd have these chains and stuff in the doorway that glowed, and it was awesome. And my dad had an afro back then. He had these big old pork chop sideburns, and he had tattoos, and You know, back in the early 70s, not everybody had tattoos like they do today, right? We got babies now born with tattoos on them, it seems like. But he had this tattoo of the devil right here, and he had one over here of this tiger, and then he had one that had mom, and he had another one that had this lady's name on it that wasn't my mom's. And best I know, no one's ever asked him who it is. I still don't know today who Wilma is. If you're out there and you're close to 80, look me up. But they'd have these parties, and it would all be kind of fun and exciting to start with, and then ultimately somebody would get, you know, mad at each other, and somebody would mess with somebody else's girl, and they'd get into a fight, or somebody would leave and get locked up, and then somebody would go get them out, and it was just chaos. And I didn't want any part of it. I'd get scared and I'd hide, and I would kind of make these promises to myself that I wasn't going to drink and wasn't going to be that way. Age of 12, I was in the basement of a neighbor's house after making those oaths to myself. And me and a friend of mine, it was his dad's house. It was his house. He had a bar in the basement similar to what my dad had, and had a bunch of liquor. And we decided we were going to drink. And I'll never forget that night. We drank. It was old granddad, 100 proof. I got that stuff down. And up to that point in my life, I mean, I had never really drank anything. I can remember having little sips of beer that my grandfather, one of my uncles, would kind of force it on me, and they would laugh at me, and I don't remember ever feeling anything from it. So I was a social drinker up to the age of 12. Kind of went into it there in the basement of that guy's house after drinking that whiskey. Now, and I'm like a lot of other people that I've heard in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, up to that point in my life, I was 12 years old, but I was absolutely just full of fear and full of doubt. I was confused about things. I didn't know the answers to anything, but I acted like I knew everything. I was afraid of people, and I was afraid to just talk to people and to ask questions about stuff. And I got that whiskey in me, and all that stuff changed. I mean, I felt like I was the king. I mean, I can remember it. It's vivid. All that fear, doubt, and confusion went away, and it just gave me power. I essentially had a spiritual experience that night when I got that whiskey in me. There was a movie called Limitless, and I think they turned it into a TV show. But that dude, I don't know if anybody's ever seen that, but that guy would take this pill called AZT. I'm not going to give a drug talk. Don't worry if you're an AA purist. I'm not. But he would take this stuff called AZT, and all of a sudden his skin color would change, and he would get strong and muscular, and he would have all this knowledge about stuff. He would know things that he's not supposed to know. He could speak six or seven different languages. He knew kung fu, jiu-jitsu, and yoga, and that's what happened. I mean, that's the best way to describe it. I mean, I took that stuff, and it just lit me up like a firecracker. And I mean, I could speak stuff and say stuff that I didn't know, and I probably knew a little kung fu at that time, and probably could do a few yoga poses. But it was absolutely magical. Next morning, I woke up in a pile of vomit. I couldn't remember anything that happened later on in the night. So, I mean, I blacked out, got sick. When I came to, I was extremely sick. First thought that came to my mind was, my God, I got to do that again. I mean, it was not, I'm going to swear this off forever. I knew that whatever that was, that I was going to get some more of it. And that's what I did. It was either the next day or a couple of days later. I went right back in the basement of that guy's house and started drinking again. And the same thing happened. All that fear, doubt, and confusion went away. And I mean, it gave me power. It made me feel like I was the king. And I'm a guy that loved alcohol. I loved everything about it. I'm not Jim mentioned it last night in his talk. Jim, that was a great talk, by the way. A little long, but it was good. It was. Matter of fact, I'm sorry. I had dinner with Jim. I was thinking as he was talking, I was like, I'm good friends with Mike, or the guy tape, or he's not even taping, he's recording. I'm like, man, I know Mike's glad he's not still using cassettes, because he'd have to have three for Jim's talk. I'm messing with you, Jim. Good talk. But he said something last night that that saying you hear in AA, your best day, what is that? Your best day sober is better than your worst day drunk, or something like that, or whatever. Vice versa, your worst day drinking is better than your whatever. That's it ain't true for me. I'm like him. I can remember being in the pool with a girl named Kim Sizek at the age of 14 or 13 or 14, and that was better than the day I had today. I can guarantee you that. Although I did have a good time with Chris on the golf course, but nothing like being in the pool though with her. And but I love drinking. I had some good times. I mean, I loved the house parties, and I discovered strobe lights and heavy metal music and girls in the basement of a house, and I just enjoyed that whole scene. And I loved getting in trouble with the law. I loved running from the law. I loved trying to out sneak them. I loved getting into trouble at school. I mean, I loved messing with girls. And I could not do that when I wasn't drinking. And I mean, I just loved everything about it. I don't think I was suffering from any kind of disease or anything like that. I was just a young kid that was just could not cope with the world, and alcohol helped me do that. And I mean, I just loved everything about it. And at the age of 17, I got into a bunch of trouble with the law, and I got charged with assault with a deadly weapon, with intent to kill, and assault on a police officer, and some other stuff. And that's how I ended up in the military. I don't know if they do that anymore. Back then, you could cut deals, and I ended up, I'll go to the military if you let me off the hook, and they let me off the hook. And I went to the Air Force thinking that my life was just automatically going to change. And I'm a guy that lives kind of in a fantasy world. I think that if I can just get the right person, or live in the right place, or have the right job, or get enough money, that things are going to be different. I went to the Air Force thinking that they're going to teach me some responsibility, I'm going to get some discipline, they're going to educate me, and things are going to be different. And up to that point in my life, my family had, they had not given up on me, but they didn't have a whole lot of hope that I was ever going to amount to anything. And I know when my mom put me on that airport in Baltimore, Maryland, to get on that plane to go to basic training, well, she was a happy woman to get me on that plane. And but I had all these intentions of just doing the right thing, and that didn't happen. I started drinking excessively. I got stationed after basic training. I got stationed up at a place called Chanute Air Force Air Base. Yeah, it's in the armpit of America. It's sorry if you're from Illinois. It was in Rantoul, Illinois, and it was just a bad place. It was cold, and but we would run into Champagne and party, and then come back to base, and everywhere they told you not to go, those are the first places that we went. But I started drinking like a fish. I'd black out and not remember what happened the night before. I'd black out and wake up the next morning, and a guy that I'd gone to the bar with, had a black eye and a broke nose, and I'm like, man, what happened to you? And he looks at me with this disgust, like, you know what happened to me. I hit him. And I don't remember. People that don't have blackouts don't believe you. When you tell them you don't know what you don't remember, they think you're lying to them. But I started blacking out a lot. I woke up, I blacked out one night. I woke up the next morning. I lived in a dorm with about 200 guys. I woke up one morning dressed with some women's clothing on, and I'm like, that's one of those times you're glad you had a blackout, because you just. you really just don't want to know. I mean, it's like, don't say anything and I won't say anything, right, type thing. And, but I thought that kind of happened to everybody. And I would just blow that stuff off like it wasn't a big deal. And I got married around this time. I look back on that. I wonder why somebody didn't stop that. But not that we would have listened. But I was drunk the day I got married. I'm surprised that old Baptist preacher married me. He must have been drinking himself. I mean, I look back on that, and we spent our honeymoon at a place called the Shaggers. Now, the Shaggers is a club, a bar, that's about 8 minutes from where we got married. You know, most people go off to the beach or to an island or somewhere nice. You know, we went to the Shaggers, and I think we got kicked out that night for fighting, and probably got maced. And woke up the next morning, and I think we had rented this townhouse in a little town called Anger. Me and my first wife are from Coates, and we knew Coates was the problem, so we wanted to take a geographical cure, so we moved 6 miles down the road to Anger. And, like, that was really going to, I mean, I really thought that was going to help something. But I think we woke up the next morning after coming from the Shaggers for a honeymoon, and I was upstairs, she was downstairs, and marriage kind of went downhill after that. And I was just a bad husband. I was physically, mentally, verbally abusive to my wife. And she was physically, mentally, verbally abusive to me. I had to say that. I mean, she probably won more than I did. But it was just a chaotic relationship. It was just one episode after another. And she'd leave and she'd come back. And I'd stay gone for 2 or 3 days and make up a bunch of lies about where I was at and what I was doing. And it was really eating me up on the inside, because I'm a guy. I've always known there was something wrong with me. I've never had any delusion that I was normal, that my life was manageable. I've just always known there was something wrong with me, and I would get conflicted on the inside about the way I was living and what I was doing. I always wanted to do the right thing, and I always wanted to be a good guy, and I always wanted to prove to, you know, my family that I could be different. But I never could get it into action. I never could do anything for more than 2 or 3 days. I mean, that was just kind of the schedule that I was on. And I made an attempt to get sober. It was January the 1st, 1989. And I had a little pressure from my wife's family to get my act in order. And my family was on me a little bit. And I had a brother that had gotten help in his church. And he told me that if I ever needed help, to give him a call. And I called him one morning and I said, "Man," I said, "I think I need some help." He said, "Well, I've been expecting the call." He said, "We've been praying for you. Come on over and let's talk." And I went and saw my brother that morning. It was January the 1st. It was a Sunday. He's getting ready to go off to church. And it's New Year's Day. It's just a great day to make some New Year's resolutions and, you know, turn your life around. And so I went over and I talked to him that morning. I think he gave me some coffee and we talked for a little bit. And he asked me if I wanted to go to church with him. And I was like, "Yeah, I'll go to church with you." So I got cleaned up a little bit. I looked rough. I'd been out for about 10 days at that point, running around. And I walked into church with him that morning. I had these pants on that were about 4 inches too short. And I had this old disco silk shirt on with a big collar on it. That's what they did when I first walked in. I think they started laughing at me. But I'll tell you what happened. They had an altar call. And I went up to the altar, and, man, they were up there praying with me. And I don't know what else they were doing. They might have rubbed some oil on my forehead or something like that. And I sat up there and cried in front of everybody and actively, you know, told him I wanted to get my life in order. And I left there that morning thinking that my life was just automatically going to change. They didn't tell me that. That was just the delusion I was living in, that just by doing that that morning, that my life was just automatically going to be different and that things were just going to start happening. And if nothing changes, nothing changes. 3 days later, I was drinking. And I stayed involved with that church for several months, and they gave me this little pocket New Testament. And I'd carry that around with me in my pocket, in my front pocket, and in my Air Force uniform. And I'd go to work, and I'd pull that thing out during breaks and start reading it and look around and make sure people were looking at me. And I just had this idea that, you know, that if I looked like I was doing the right thing, that, you know, that things would be different, that people would think I was doing the right thing. And I'd start maybe, you know, testifying to a few people and preaching to them. And I'd go out in the parking lot and drink some vodka and pop a couple Percocets, come back in and talk to them some more. And it was just crazy. And I started listening to this gospel music, and I'd sing this gospel music in the car, and I had this book called The Daily Bread, and I would read that, and I'd get that New Testament, and I was just in absolute full flight from reality. And around this time, I shaved my head, and I thought, I worked with a guy that drank like I did, and there were three of us that would go off to, we would drink a lot during work. And one morning, he shows up for work, and his head was shaved, and I was like, man, what's up with your head? And he said that he had hooked up with his organization that believed that the problems of man stems from their hair. And it's a true story. And that their program of action is that when you shave your hair, that signifies the old man dying or the old ideas die. And when your hair grows back, you're reborn and you're given kind of new ideas. I was like, man, I need some of that. I went home and I shaved my head. And I look like a complete idiot. I'd gotten into a fight a little before that, and this guy in Fayetteville had hit me in the head with this big stick, and I had this big fresh scar on my head, and I looked like Charles Manson coming into work the next morning. People were like, they were looking at me, and they're like, man. And I stayed sober for 3 days with that shaved head. Yeah. I don't know how long the other guy stayed sober. I don't think it was very long, but and I see some folks in here have tried it. Chris has tried it. Yeah. If you get more than 3 days out of it, let me know. And here's what I would. So I'm riding around listening to gospel music, reading the New Testament, preaching to people. I got that shaved head. I'm looking, you know, and I don't know what's wrong with me. I mean, I can't stay sober. I'm blind to everybody. And this is how things would go. This is like textbook alcoholism right here. There's a couple stories in the book Alcoholics Anonymous that basically describe this same phenomenon here. The other guy that I would drink with, one day I'm sitting there and I'm giving him the business with my New Testament and all that, and it shaved head. And then he asked me if I wanted to go to his house for lunch, which was not unusual. We would go to his house periodically for lunch. We'd always end up drinking, but sometimes we actually would eat stuff. And so I'm like, yeah, I'll go to your house. And so he's driving, and on the way over there, I'm laying it on him about how I've changed and the church has fixed me, and I got my New Testament. I probably read a little scripture to him. And I'm just giving it to him pretty good. And he's just kind of listening, yeah, and I'm telling him how, you know, my life is different. We walk into his house, and we go into the kitchen, and he's like, hey, Jerry, you want a beer? And I'm like, yeah, I'll take this one. And that's alcoholism. and I was off to the races. 30 seconds before that, I was, I'd sworn it off forever. And when he offered it, I just reached for it. And what would happen over the next few months is I would go into an absolute just dark depression, just full of anxiety, thinking that the world was out to get me and that I didn't have any value. My family would be better off without me. I became suicidal. I attempted suicide 3 times. They tell me that I died twice. The second suicide attempt, I had a dog that had mange. And this will confirm that I'm not the brightest guy in the room tonight. I had this idea that if that poison would kill mange, it might kill a man. And so one night I pulled some of it up into a syringe and I shot it up my arm. I laid down on the kitchen floor and went away from here for a little while. And there was nothing dramatic about it at the time. I didn't call anybody or write a note. I wanted to check out. I just wanted to die. I really just felt like everybody would be better off without me. And I mean, I did it just as easy as I'd go there and get a cup of coffee. I mean, there was no thought that maybe this isn't a good idea. And that led to, I was in the hospital for 5 days after that. And when I was in the hospital for those 5 days, I knew I would never drink again after going through that experience. I would probably never stick any needles in my arm, and that my life was going to be different. I even had somewhat of this idea that I'd been enlightened, and I had these fantasies that, you ever see these on some of these movies or TV shows where these people have these near-death experiences and they come back as angels, or they come back and they got superpowers. I mean, I kind of had thought that that might happen to me. And I was out of the hospital for about 3 days. And I remember having a discussion with my dad right when I got out of the hospital about how things were different this time. Never going to do any of that stuff again. And I left Pope Air Force Base with the intent to go straight home. And those voices went off in my head, man, you're making a big deal out of nothing. You probably could just drink some beer. Matter of fact, if you get the small beers, the 8-ounce beers, instead of a big one, it probably will be okay. And what sealed the deal was, if you eat a Slim Jim before you drink the beer, you'd definitely be okay because it coats your stomach and all that stuff, right? I stopped at the Quick Stop and bought me a Slim Jim and an 8-pack of Budweiser's. The ponies now, the 8-ounce beers, and I don't know if they make them anymore, and I was off to the races. When our literature says that we've lost the power of choice in drink, that's what happened to me both of those times, was that here I am, I'm 8 days from killing myself. I caused my family just undreamed of worry and terror, and both of my parents had to break the law to get me into a civilian hospital under somebody else's name, and it was just devastating to the family, and not to mention me. And I could not bring that into my mind with sufficient amount of force to stop me from not taking that first drink. So I know what it means when the book says that we have no defense against the first drink. I have no defense against the first drink. It doesn't matter how much my wife loves me. It doesn't matter how much my mom loves me. It doesn't matter how much the authorities threaten me. The doctor gives me a warning that when that hits in my mind, I'm going to take a drink. And so I have lost the power of choice. I've got no more choice today than I did then. And that's why I need Alcoholics Anonymous, and that's why I need the power that I found in Alcoholics Anonymous. That's my defense against the first drink. If I don't stay close to Alcoholics Anonymous and stay in the middle and practice Alcoholics Anonymous as a way of life, I will lose my defense, and something will happen, and I'll go take a drink at some point. I don't think it'll happen immediately, but I'll get sick and eventually do that. And that's what happened to me that day. Now, the good news about all that is I've never had the mange. And uh, And I'll submit to you a couple of things here real quick, and I'll move on off of that. But I think that mane stuff has helped my hair as I've aged. I mean, most people, when they start aging, most men, when they start aging, their hair falls out. Well, mine hadn't. It just keeps on coming. You should have seen it yesterday before I got it cut, man. It was like way out there. So if you, yeah, I wouldn't recommend trying it. So I, basically after that, what happened was I started living like an animal. For the next few months, I started doing things that I never thought I would do. I started hanging out with people that I never thought I'd hang out with. My wife basically has left, and we're getting ready to lose the little house that we were living in. The 72 Volkswagen that I had, the motor blowed up in that, and it's sitting behind the house, and I'm basically walking and basically just living like an animal. I don't know how else to describe it. I'm getting paranoid. I think people are out to get me. I'm hearing voices and hearing sirens, and there's nobody there. And I came to at a guy's house. I wouldn't say I came to. I'd been up for a long time. But I made a decision to go write a bad check at a grocery store. And I left his house that morning basically walking and interesting thing about that morning, there was nobody on me putting pressure on me to do anything. There were no ultimatums being made. There was no interventions or anything like that. By that point, everybody I blamed my life on was leaving me alone. And I had kind of gotten to the point to where I had just kind of given up, and I just knew that it was going to be over soon. It just wasn't a big deal. And, I mean, I left Wayne's house that morning just kind of, There wasn't anything going on. And as I was walking down the road, it was about an 8-mile walk, and my plan was to get to the main road, and then I was going to hitchhike into town, and somebody would have picked me up. But as I was walking down the road that morning, it was like my whole life flashed before my eyes. I had this moment of clarity, and It was something like you've just turned 22 years old. Your life should be starting. It shouldn't be ending. And that I had this kind of knowledge come to me that I was just an absolute zero and had done a very poor job at trying to run my life. And I said a couple things out loud. I said, there's got to be something better than this. And then I said, God, please help me. Right after I said, God, please help me, I looked over and there was a little house on the side of the road there. This was about 6 in the morning. It's a rural area, but there was a house right there on the side of the road, and the front door was open and the main door was open. There was a screen door there, and there was a lady sitting in a rocking chair in there. And next thing I know, I'm up at the door. I don't know how I got up there, but I'm up at the door asking her if I can borrow the phone. And she said, sure, come on in. I walked in, I got on the phone, I called my dad. I asked my dad if he'd come pick me up. And that was a hard phone call to make, given where I was at and what was going on. And his wife at the time was cussing at him in the background, saying, don't tell him not to go pick me up. They were getting ready to leave to go on a family vacation. And she was a little pissed off at him. I had stolen a car from her a few weeks before that. And I always say she shouldn't have left the key in it, but he came and he picked me up, and he kind of crushed the last lie that was in my mind, was that nobody cares. And when I got in the car with him, the very first thing out of my mouth was, I need some help. And I had never said it like that. I mean, that morning that I got that, I was in that church, and I went up there, and those folks prayed with me. I wanted to get help just as bad that day as I did this day. My life was in worse shape that morning than it was that morning. I don't know what the difference was. But when I told him I needed some help, it was like this burden lifted off of me. And I mean, it wasn't like some big sense of freedom, but something was different. And for some reason, he knew what to do, and that's when he took me to that detox. And in that detox, that guy from Alcoholics Anonymous came and he talked to me. Some really strange things happened in that detox. They did a little assessment on me before the guy from AA came in. They asked me if I had insurance. And I was like, sure, I got insurance. At that point, I've never had insurance. But I had been discharged out of the Air Force. And I said, yeah, I got insurance. And they said, well, we also need some money. And this was, you know, the late 80s, and the high-dollar treatment centers were kind of in full force then. And I said, well, I got money. I can write you a check. So I ended up writing a bad check. And I did end up writing a bad check. I wrote him a bad check for $500 to get into the detox. So they call that going any lengths for anybody that's... So when they started talking to me and doing this assessment on me, some really strange things happened. Some really strange things came out of my mouth. It was the truth. I actually, like, for the first time in my life, told the guy the truth about what was going on with me and what I'd been doing. And, I look back on that day that all those things happened. That whatever happened to me wasn't me. I didn't have enough power to ask that lady if I could borrow the phone. I didn't have enough power to ask my dad for help. I didn't have enough power of him by myself to tell that guy the truth in that detox. And I look back on that, and something happened to me, and it today I don't believe it was any different than what happened to Bill Wilson, that experience that he had in the hospital. It certainly wasn't a blinding light and a clean wind blowing through me, but I was surrendered that day, and it didn't come from me. And I wouldn't try to tell you where it came from or describe any kind of label to put on it, but something happened. And from that day to this day, I've continued to get better. From that day to this day, I've continued to stay sober regardless of what life has thrown at me. And you don't hear that in Alcoholics Anonymous much, but that's my experience. A couple of days after that guy made that 12-step call on me, I started going to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. I gave my wasted and busted life to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous without any clue what was going on. I heard people tell their stories, and it floored me, the message there and how kind of consistent it was with the way that I lived. And I was a guy that was a skeptic. I was brought up to not believe anything, always be skeptical of what you hear. And for some reason, when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous meetings, that disappeared. I can't explain today. I'm still skeptical about a lot of other stuff, but when it comes to Alcoholics Anonymous and most people in Alcoholics Anonymous, that's not there. And I wasn't a guy that felt like I had been returned to my family or anything stuff like that, but I was glad to know what was wrong with me and that there was a solution. And I was quickly introduced to the literature, to a group, to a sponsor. I started taking the steps. Did my first 5th step at about 5 weeks sober. I started going out and making amends to people at about 7 or 8 weeks sober. I had to just to be able to go out into public because people were looking at me, and I owed people money, and I had bad checks out there, and I'd hurt people. And, you know, I went back and talked to my family. I went back and made good on bad checks, even though I didn't have money. I was told you still had to go talk to people and make arrangements. I went down to the courthouse and turned myself in for warrants that were down there, which is kind of strange. Normally, if they got a warrant out, you wait till they come get you. I was like, right? And these people said, no, you got to go down and just turn yourself in and, you know, pray about it and trust. And, well, that's easy for you to say. You're not the one having to go down there and do it. But you know what? That's what I did because I didn't want to return to the life that I was in. And so I went down and, you know, and it all worked out. People worked with me. I found out really quick when you actually told the truth and you're not working angles and shucking and jiving, people will actually try to help you. And that was my experience. And it's interesting because some of that, you know, I mean, what it looked to me like what I needed was I needed my wife to come back. even though she didn't at that time. And I needed a car, and I needed a place to live, and I needed you to give me a job and give me some money and throw in a therapist and some medication, and everything would be wonderful. And I was kind of taught the exact opposite of all that stuff. You know, hey, you're the one that lost the car and the house and the job and the wife. Why don't you just stay away from all that stuff and focus on getting sober and taking these steps? And maybe when you get better spiritually, everything else will kind of will follow that. And that's actually what that's been my experience throughout the years, is that when I focus on my spiritual condition, everything else comes. And my life started to get better very quickly. And I got a guy took a chance on me and gave me a job. And me and my first wife got back together after I was sober about 9 months. We got that house back that we'd lost. And I'm doing good on my job, and things are going well. I'm sponsoring people in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm sober about 3 or 4 years. My wife comes home and says she's leaving, which was a little bit of a shock to me. And she finally realized she liked other guys more than she liked me. And that was okay. When that happened, it was kind of like it was one of the first times where the steps really, I mean, it wasn't the first time, but they really kicked in, and my actions were a little different than they had been in the past. Because when she came home and told me that she was moving back in with her mom, normally I'd fight, I'd put up a fight. And I said, okay, what do I got to do to help you? And that wasn't me. And anyway, what happened was, and so she left, and I was devastated. I'm also stealing money from work. That's why I said you got to watch out that book right there. And I'd been stealing money from work for a couple years and justifying it because they don't pay me enough money. And, I work hard. And I thank God for good sponsorship. When I finally got honest with my sponsor about the way that I was living and some of the things that I was doing, I mean, he offered me a spiritual solution to what appeared to be an impossible problem. Long story short, I got through a divorce. He told me to go file for separation. I'm like, whoa, whoa, love and tolerance of others. I mean, I thought he was going to try to help me get her back. And anybody involved in it knew it was best for us to not be together anymore. And I filed for separation, and he told me that I had to go back to my employer and make an amends for stealing thousands of dollars. And I'm like, some of y'all get a kick out of this. I'm like, well, whoa, wait a minute now. I said, it says right here in the step that we made amends except when to do so would injure them or others. I'm an other. And now you would think at about 4 or 5 years sober by this point, I would know that I'm not another. But that's what he did. He kind of chuckled like that. And he says, well, didn't your wife leave? I was like, yeah. And he says, you don't have any kids, do you? I was like, no. He says, well, if you lose your job or get locked up, nobody's going to be hurt but you. And he's like, look, that's kind of cold. I was like, so I went and made an amends to my employer. This guy took a risk on me, newly sober, and gave me part of the business. And I mean, I felt bad about what I'd done, and I asked him if I could meet with him, and we met, and I laid out exactly what I'd done, how much money I'd stolen, how I'd done it, and he looked at me and he says he thanked me for all the hard work and things I'd done there. And then he said, I've been forgiven for worse. He said, the best thing we can do is just forget about this and move on. Of course, my first thought was, well, I wonder what he did. Not, man, thank God he's letting me off the hook. He's like, wonder what he did. And I'm a guy that is blessed by non-alcoholics. I mean, I have had so many non-alcoholics help me, and so many non-alcoholics that have taught me how to live by spiritual principles. And he was one of them. And I was prepared to lose my job. I was prepared to go to jail. I had already planned how I was going to start a meeting in the jail when they locked me up. And he didn't fire me. I paid the money back because it wasn't mine to take. And I mean, not long after that, I got a promotion with that company and started making money. And it was doesn't make any sense to me, actually. I got through that divorce without any fighting or arguing. It was easy, as easy as a divorce can be, because of Alcoholics Anonymous and people in Alcoholics Anonymous that basically taught me and told me what to do and how to act. And what happened to me was at about 5 years sober going through all that. I mean, I can remember just being depressed and just thinking, I was in a very dark spot with all that going on, and I start blaming God and start blaming the program. And I mean, it's just crazy where your mind can go. And you start thinking this stuff don't work, even though it works 100% perfectly. When I actually do it, I'm the one not doing it. And I was with my sponsor one day, and we were talking about step 6 and 7. This was after I'd made the amends and gotten through the divorce. And this is one of those life-changing situations for me. I try to share this all the time because it's very simple, but it changed my life. I told my sponsor, I'm like, there's not a lot in the big book on steps 6 and 7. And he looked at me and he says, Jerry, if there was more you could do, there'd be more written. And he went into this deal about how our job is to give up and to surrender and to literally be willing to change. And that when you're willing to change, that power will show up and help you to heal and give you power to do the opposite of what you used to do. And, that we don't need to go to any other books or that people complicate step 6 and complicate step 7. That's it's truly of the question is, do you want to change or don't you? He asked me, are you ready to stop playing games with your life? Are you ready to grow up? Are you ready to actually believe in the power of God and not just talk about it? And that's what I did. I mean, I gave it lip service in certain areas of my life. I turned over about 80% and I kept 20%. I kept the money and the relationship because I didn't believe that there was anything better for me. I'm scared that I'm not going to be taken care of financially, so I got to kind of manage that and enhance it. And basically what I did was made it worse. And that literally changed the course of my life when he made that comment to me. And I started looking at the world different. I started looking at Alcoholics Anonymous differently. And I started to literally try to practice Alcoholics Anonymous as a way of life. And it's not just something that I go to. And it's not a crapshoot or just kind of some kind of first aid kit for alcoholism. That Alcoholics Anonymous is a way of life. That I'm actually supposed to take it to me at work and in my family and in the community. And I got really kind of just actively involved in consciously trying to take God with me everywhere that I went. I consciously tried to take those traditions with me everywhere I went. I learned how to interact with people and learn how to actually negotiate with people through the AA's first tradition. I learned how to listen to people without trying to respond through the AA's second tradition. I learned how to respect other people's opinions, and I learned how to not be filled with prejudice towards certain people because of the third tradition. The third tradition taught me that everybody's equal. We're all equal. And that I shouldn't have any hate in my heart or any prejudice in me. If I really believe in the power of God and principles that are outlined in our 36 principles. And my life started to drastically change at work and at home when I started doing that. And I started treating people at work and in my home as good as I did in my home group. And things started to change. And I'd given up on women after that divorce. And the minute I had some serious resentments But the minute I got over resentment, it's like a woman just popped up out of the ground. And we dated for a little while, and we got married. We tried to do things a little differently than I had in the past. And that younger brother that tried to help me in the church became a preacher, and he flew in from Afghanistan and married us. And my sponsor and my dad stood up, and both of them were my best men. There were a bunch of folks from Alcoholics Anonymous there, and we got married, and we've been married now for, I don't know, about 22 years. And I have a good marriage because of Alcoholics Anonymous, and well, thanks. And because of men in AA that have taught me how to treat women differently than I used to. I haven't stolen anything since then. Which is a good thing. That was removed when I gave up. And I learned in the seventh tradition how to give back and how to actually be self-supporting through my own contributions. I learned how to actually be charitable. Alcoholics Anonymous has been very, very good to me since that time financially because of people in AA that have taught me how to do things different. Because of our traditions. And I worked at that company for 18 more years and went from basically sweeping the floor to being a president of one of their companies. And managed over $1 billion and 1,500 people. All riding the steps and the traditions. They'd send me off to these leadership camps, and I'd have these personal coaches that would help you and spend thousands of dollars. And I learned way more in my home group than I did from those folks. and was able to do things that a guy like me, I mean, it's not supposed to be possible. It doesn't make sense on paper. But it does make sense when you give up and you surrender and you let that power help you. I guess most importantly, I'm going to sit down here. Before I got sober and was going through those suicide attempts, I mean, I never really wanted to live past 24 or past 22. I mean, I just didn't. It just didn't seem like there was any purpose in it. And I can remember when I first got sober, wondering what it was all about and what life was about and you know, what God had in store for me if I was able to stay sober. And I just wanted to get maybe a car and a little job and maybe my wife come back and stop sleeping with my cousin. AA has given me way more than just sobriety. It has given me a relationship with a power greater than myself. And that power has come into me and has transformed me and has given me a different way to think, feel, and believe. And that power that has given me a different way to think, feel, and believe has also given me purpose. And I'm a guy that believes that we have been given the power to avert death and misery for others. I don't take that lightly. I don't think those are words in a book. I think that's real. And my job is to help other people. My job is to carry the message of Alcoholics Anonymous to other alcoholics and to be a good example of the principles in my community and at home and everywhere that I go. And I started doing prison work when I was about 3 months sober. And when I first started going to prison, there was a guy that I met in there at the meeting. And he stayed involved for a couple months, and he disappeared. 6 years later, I mean, I never knew what happened to the guy. 6 years later, I'm at a group in Raleigh, not my group, and this guy comes up to me and says, "You don't remember me, do you?" I was like, "Well, as a matter of fact, I do. I saw you years ago at Harnett Correctional." He's like, "That's right." He says, "You guys saved my life." He got transferred and continued to stay involved in the program. And this was 6 years later. I hadn't seen him. He was a GSR of that group. That guy would later go on to get married, have kids. He's a professor at a major university today. Went from being an armed robber, bank robber, to a professor at a university. All because a couple guys came into a prison and tried to help him. They weren't sitting at home watching Jeopardy or worrying about me and my recovery or whatever that self-love, self-help, and all that stuff is. There were two guys who were willing to go carry the message to somebody that couldn't get it. And those two guys didn't change that guy, but they set the path for change to happen. And that's our responsibility, is to try to help each other and try to help other alcoholics. Thank you. Yeah.